Hi everyone, welcome to Tyndall Talks, the Tyndall Center's official podcast. I'm Renee from the Tyndall Center at the University of East Anglia. Our episode today is about the role of carbon dioxide removal, or CDR, in national climate strategies. A recent paper by Harry Smith, Dr. Nambuhan, and Dr. Johanna Forster highlights the risks of countries relying on nature-based solutions to achieve net zero. To date, around 146 countries have set out a net zero target, committing to reducing their emissions across the decades ahead. Some emissions, however, are difficult to decarbonize and are balanced out by removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. The study found that once the bulk of the emissions have been reduced, most countries plan to remove the leftover difficult to decarbonize emissions through forests and soils, which can also absorb carbon from the atmosphere. However, this may prove risky because forests and soils are also threatened by a range of impacts, such as fire, disease, changes in farming practices, or deforestation. These mean forests and soils could lose their stored carbon back to the atmosphere. So what do countries need to do next? To talk to us more about the role of carbon dioxide removal in national climate strategies is the author and co-author of the paper, Harry Smith and Nambuhan. Harry Smith is a PhD researcher on the climate governance of carbon dioxide removal and part of the Critical Decade for Climate Change program with the Leverhulme Trust at the UEA. Dr. Nambuhan is an associate professor of climate change whose research is focused on carbon dioxide removal and its role in mitigating climate change. So hello, Nam and Harry. Welcome to this episode of the Tyndall Talks.
Hiya.
Hello, Renee. Great to be with you.
Hi, and I guess your paper has had quite a few media interests as well. So it's very important this year in the context of, I guess, the climate governance. We have the COP28 Global Stocktake, and a lot of people will be talking about, you know, the net zero. Are we on track? Are we not? So for those who don't know, what is carbon dioxide removal? And what is CDR's role in decarbonization and net zero?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll kick off on that question. Hasnam, you can add what you feel I missed. So carbon dioxide removal is essentially a range of methods that act to remove mainly CO2 from the atmosphere and permanently store it elsewhere. So it could be what's termed geological sinks, so underground, in old oil and gas wells or different, say, in aquifers, for example, or in terrestrial sinks, so tends to be in some biomass. It's quite a vast field and it's moving quite quickly, so the terminology is always in flux. The IPCC use CDR, carbon dioxide removal, but you might hear negative emission technologies. In the UK, it's greenhouse gas removal to allow some sort of the potential for other greenhouse gases to be removed as well. So it's a fast moving area, and that's the core definition. And then when it comes to roles, people are sort of familiar with some of the methods of CDR. They're familiar with the tree planting, for example, and afforestation. Perhaps they're grown familiar with what's known as direct air capture, which is using chemicals to scrub the ambient air of CO2 and store it underground. The roles are much sort of lesser known. The IPCC sets out about three different roles in the latest Working Group 3 report, first of which is if you deploy CDR in the here and now and across some of the decades ahead, you're accelerating your near-term emission reductions. So there's debate as to whether that's actually the case, whether CDR politically sort of traps us into perhaps lesser emission reductions in the near term. But generally, if you're deploying CDR and pursuing mitigation elsewhere, reducing emissions in fossil fuel use, for example, then you're speeding up the rate of emission reductions, typically 2030, 2040 and beyond. So as you near net zero target for a specific country, the sort of role changes to balancing out what's termed residual emissions. So these are the difficult to decarbonize emissions that either they're too costly to get rid of, essentially, or abate, or we don't have the technology to do so, or perhaps as a society, we decided that we don't want to necessarily. They fit certain social logics that make them demand, for example, for a certain good can increase. So that's, in that case, CDRs used to balance out for those positive emissions. And then finally, what people often miss is that for many countries, it's about going beyond net zero. And so CDR is also part of this push towards net negative. And that can be for either overshoot, we go beyond at the global level, certain temperature targets, below past 1.5 perhaps. And later in the century, we have a period of net negative emissions across the global economy to help us bring back down our temperature targets. Or it's part of a sort of climate justice frame as well. So countries with the legacy of emissions and also the capital to do so should hit net zero sooner, go net negative after that, to allow for other countries to decarbonize more gradually. So there's a whole range of roles, and they change across time, which is part of the hard parts of getting your head around CDR.
So I suppose I'd just do the little summary on that, which is carbon removal is really valuable and useful tool, which, as Harry set out, has these different roles over time. But it doesn't in any way undo the need to reduce our emissions. So this is an on top of, not an instead of, right? So we have to do our deep decarbonisation, switch to renewables, leave the coal, oil and gas in the ground. We have to do all of that. And this is an addition to that. And so that is an interesting how different countries are interpreting how they could use carbon removal, because it very clearly gets mixed up with the idea of an offset, which gets mixed up with, I won't bother doing the hard work, I'll just pay for the offset. And so you can see how CDR can fall into that trap. So, you know, I won't change my business practice, I won't engage with decarbonization, or I'll do it slower, or I'll just open a bunch more oil fields whilst I can, right? Because we've got this to do later. And so I think Harry's really given you the detail there, but that's the core thing that I'd just add to your listeners to remember, is that this doesn't let us off the hook of leaving the fossil fuels in the ground and decarbonizing. This is a really valuable tool that we can use to help limit climate impacts and get to net zero as quickly as possible, achieve net zero, and then, as Harry was just stating there, being able beyond that to have any ability to come down from a temperature target. So this idea of overshooting our temperature, and that directly will then relate to the amount of impacts. So we could be on track for a world with a lot of very negative impacts, and CDR allows us to come back from that position and actually improve that situation. So I think it's a really precious and useful thing, set of technologies and approaches that should be used sparingly and appropriately, and others would interpret them as a way to keep flying loads and burn more oil and gas. So there's very different imaginaries there.
Yeah, and you actually have a very good point there, because, you know, I've worked in the climate space for a long time with a lot of different organizations, and when they hear carbon dioxide removal, they're immediately, you know, putting their backs up and are like, but, you know, this is not the real solution. We shouldn't be. The discourse is really negative on carbon dioxide removal, yeah, basically. So I'm really interested in your study. What did you find, and why is it important, I guess, for countries to start looking at the carbon dioxide removal?
Yeah, absolutely. So CDR to date, part of the what largely fuels discourse is the fact that it's been analysed in these global assessment models. So what's known as IAM's integrated assessment models that the IPCC uses to essentially flesh out emission pathways to a certain temperature target. And that's informed a lot of the CDR discourse to date, but what it misses is the politics and the policy of CDR at the national level. Ultimately, climate action is fulfilled by countries. And so when it comes to countries reducing their emissions and pursuing CDR and ultimately reaching net zero, we have to pay attention to what countries are planning to do. And that's where our sort of study comes in. So to date, there's what's known as the NDCs, the Paris Agreement, the Nationally Determined Contributions. These are the short-term pledges, typically to 2030, although they'll be to 2035 very soon. They essentially steer the near-term ambition for countries. What that misses, of course, is the fact that CDR changes over time. It's mainly a need in these pathways that IPCC set out in the 2040s and 2050s and beyond, across the sort of latter half of the century. So what that means is that we have to pay attention to how countries envisage their full decarbonization pathway. And so what we looked at is something called LTLEDs, long-term low emission development strategies. It's a very not particularly nice acronym, but essentially these are our national climate strategies. What they represent is a country's first sort of take approach to envisaging a pathway to 2050 or beyond. And they're part of the Paris Agreement, but they're not as strong as the NDCs. The NDCs are the bedrock of things like the global stocktake as well. They're really quite crucial in terms of steering the ship of climate policy in the near term. What the long-term low emission strategies do is they help guide countries in the long-term needs of net zero. So there's probably some needs towards the end of decarbonization that you don't necessarily flesh out in your near-term decade. And so CDR, I think, fits into that. And so we set out to analyze these strategies. They've just become sort of a critical mass, if you will. They've just hit enough of them that they cover the global economy in terms of emissions and GDP and things like this. And so we took those. There's about 41 that we analyzed, because those are the ones that were published in English. About 4,000 pages of policy and analysis. It was a very long few months for us, nevertheless enjoyable. And what we pulled out is essentially, firstly, quantified modeling when it comes to CDR, and then also what they say about CDR, essentially. And what we found is that the majority of this 41 don't actually quantify residual emissions. They're not too interested in the balance of sources and sinks at the point of net zero. They don't go far enough in their modeling, or they don't include modeling at all. Those that do, there's about 20 of them, about 13 use primarily or solely forests and soils to compensate for those residual emissions. So when it comes to those ongoing hard to abate sectors, things like agriculture, also things like heavy transport and some of the difficult to decarbonize industries as well, those are being offset by forests and soils, or compensated, not strictly offset. But that comes with its own risks, right? So ultimately, some of those countries also set out their concerns about this type of strategy. So they're concerned about wildfires, they're concerned about pests, disease. They're also concerned about the ways in which we can estimate these fluxes in the first place. The carbon stored in these forests is actually very hard to do. This is so great, in fact, that if you look at the models that some of the IPCC use, what's called bookkeeping models, versus what the countries present in terms of their national inventories, these big data sets that estimate their emissions, we're not even too sure whether the whole of the land use sector is a source or a sink. Like, that's the degree of error we're facing. So when it comes to then using that in the net zero sort of logic, that brings about its own risks. So that's kind of what we explored in this paper, is the risk of doing so.
Yeah, I think Harry set that detail out there. I think again, the kind of pricey version is that countries are having to, there's like, we want to get to net zero. And then as a country, you've got to step back and go, okay, how do we get to net zero? And what we found is that of the policy documents, only about half really try and run the numbers on this, try to work out where they might be. So the UK CCC have got a good history of doing this, for example, right? They tried to calculate what our emissions would be in 2050 under certain sets of decisions with certain technologies available, certain practices, you know, and each country's situation is really different. We find countries that have always historically retained a lot of their forests don't have a lot of potential to plant new forests. We see this in Japan. We see this in South Korea, for example. You have countries that are very unique in that they are very small and highly and densely populated with very little additional landmass, like Singapore. We have countries across Europe on average have around 33% forest cover. In the UK, it's 13, islands about the same. And so we've got a lot of potential to afforest, to increase this carbon removal to be offset, but that's because we deforested already, right? And so there is, it's kind of like starting to think through, as Harry said, starting to think through what would net zero mean for each individual country, its unique geography, its unique history of where its industries are, what geology it has available maybe to do some of this storage, or what land area could be forested. Obviously, if a country has still got a lot of its original forests, the number one most useful thing is to stop deforesting, right? Obviously, there's that. And so I do think these LTLEDs are definitely a first thinking process for countries, right? And some have thought about it more and in more detail, and some haven't yet. But what we have seen is this initial thinking and these initial numbers tend to see interest in investment and plans around forests and soils, which are really great things to do for biodiversity, for climate resilience. There's lots of really good reasons that you plant more forests, you protect your forests first of all, you restore and plant more forests where needed, and that you do, you try to reverse the soil carbon loss we see internationally, because that causes big problems for food security, etc. So try to reduce those emissions, and then try to get more carbon back in your soils, changing how you farm, etc. Right? And we see lots of different examples of this. But what we're saying is, it's risky to depend on those strategies to be balancing out on your net zero accounting books in 2050. CO2 emissions from aviation, right? Because they're very different things. As Harry sets out at the end of the paper quite clearly, these LTLEDs are a first pass, and that they need to be revisited. And we'll also see it now at a city scale, at a region scale, in different countries across the globe, trying to come to terms with what net zero means, you know, as a university, as a company, as a city, as a region, and how do we get there? And these LTLEDs are a version of, at a country level, trying to think out how you get there. And we're just highlighting some of the, if you like, some of the kind of mistakes or misjudgments we think are happening there, which might mean you're going to have to do more on your decarbonisation. You're going to have to look again at how difficult really is this difficult to decarbonize. And the other thing you might need to look at is the type of carbon dioxide removal that tries to store CO2 deep underground. So Harry mentioned this at the beginning. One form is direct air capture and storage. We've seen a few small companies start up trialing this stuff out across the globe. And that might prove to be a really useful technology, but it requires kind of support from governments. It'll only suit certain locations in terms of what storage is available. And there's a lot of scope for innovation there to try and bring the price of that down, but that they also need to be considered by certain countries. And so we're seeing this in a couple of countries who've already thought about them and spotted they don't have the geology, the right geology to do this. So they're going to have to start talking to countries nearby that they might be able to, for example, transport the CO2 to. But each time, I think the logic is about coming back to, hang on, how difficult really is difficult? Is it difficult to decarbonize, or are we just being a bit lazy on this? Do you know what I mean? Like, can we look again? Is there scope for more innovation there? You know, can we drive the price down and think about demand changes and different ways of doing things? But I think that's the kind of upshot. The more you look at this CDR, the more you realize you need to be very critical and scrutinize what you think is difficult to decarbonize. So it's about thinking it through. So I think it's fair enough that there's some of these, if you like, mistakes in there, because it's the first part of the process. And definitely it's more obvious in the ones that have bothered to do the maths, to try and think through the numbers. So about, as Harry said, about half of our data set just didn't try and think through the numbers, you know, which gives you much more flexibility.
Yeah. So I guess you've actually quite answered why it's important to quantify and look at, you know, how much carbon dioxide removal methods actually is going to help with decarbonizing countries and with the long-term strategies. So I am curious, in the countries that you analyzed, are there any good examples of countries that have quantified their carbon dioxide removal methods? And what are the good practices that they are doing right now?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the immediate example that springs to mind is Switzerland. And the reason I like Switzerland is that you can see the degree of thinking that producing this LTLEDs sort of creates. And what's interesting about Switzerland is that it has a very small forest sector. Its agriculture sector is not particularly huge as well. But they have a few industries, but mainly finance. That's the core of their economy. So they're quite a rich economy, but it's quite a small industry. So they have quite a large decarbonization potential. They can get rid of a lot of emissions with existing technologies. But there's a bunch that remain, particularly cement, and particularly what little agriculture they do have. Essentially, what they do is they do this bottom-up process. They say, we have these, the outcome of our modeling is that some of this is hard to abate. There's some of this we can avoid through carbon capture and storage, which is essentially applying the capturing CO2 to different point sources, so different industries, for example. And that will get us slightly further along when it comes to net zero. Then the rest we can look at in terms of CDR. When it comes to CDR, we also have to consider what types and methods we employ. So we don't have a huge forest sector. That means we can't really afforest on a meaningful scale. Therefore, let's look towards what industries we do have. We have a large waste incineration sector. And we can use part of the biogenic waste that goes into those waste incinerators to perform negative emissions if we apply carbon capture to the sort of back end. And the rest we need to look at in terms of direct air capture. Most notably, we don't have much geological storage either. And what that means is that they need to form collaborations with the rest of the EU, particularly around the around Norway and the parts of the North Sea, for example, towards geological storage and perhaps even doing direct air capture abroad. So transferring the CO2 on between countries on sort of one another's behalf. So you can see the change in the policy response simply by doing those hard sums. I think it's also useful to compare perhaps a bad example of this. I mean, Australia is an interesting one. It just shows that quantification can also be slightly misused. Perhaps I think that's that's an understatement. But the Australian government has, of course, changed in recent times. But the Australian government previously produced this net zero strategy. And essentially what they use is they use all the soil carbon that they feel they have a huge potential for this. They have huge farms in Australia. They plowed all that soil carbon back into retaining their fossil fuel export sector. So we're not going to decarbonize that, even though that might not be technically hard to abate according to the sort of techno-economic assessments of where technology currently is. But nevertheless, we want to retain that because it's part of our economic geography and it's part of our politics as well. And so we can use soil carbon, which is a CDR method, to essentially give us a bit more emission reductions, not the crucial element of balancing residual emissions. And there you're potentially using some of your potential as a country to not decarbonize your economy. So it shows that you can do these sums sort of well and take into account your geography in a very meaningful way. You can also use those, sort of misuse those as well in your net zero strategy.
And I think that really resonates, Renee, with what you were saying earlier about caution, you know, like people's different organizations and groups that you've worked with and conversations you've been involved with before. And you see that, you know, like, I think it's quite rightly a number of organizations are critical. You can see that how Harry set a really good example there, albeit it's not the current Australian government. It was the previous one, but it just gives you a really good example. That was the one in our data set to analyze. Gives you a really good example of this misuse, right? The kind of misuse of CDR to let you continue having a massive oil and gas industry, right? Which, and a large mining industry that you don't, you know, kind of deal with the kind of embedded emissions there. But the other thing that Harry mentioned about Switzerland and the ability to get another country to do the removals for you, that also is a route that one can see through, you know, present day lived experience and parallel kind of industries and organizations. It just won't add up globally, right? You'll see countries saying, well, I'm going to continue to do this. I'm going to claim that's too difficult. I'm going to continue to have exactly the same. You know, these are my choices in terms of what our country's going to do or not do. And then if I don't have the natural resources, either the storage or the land area, to do much on the kind of forest and soils front, then what we're going to do is pay someone else to do that. And then again, we're getting into you can see a real potential there for environmental and social injustice and inequalities to merely be exacerbated. You know, you can see that that's an obvious form of this kind of misuse. So either you use your numbers to smoke and mirror and you have a net zero target that doesn't actually get to net zero, or you it does work, but you allow this international, you allow someone else to do the work for you. And in some cases, and done well, that will make sense because, you know, there are some countries that really are very constrained by their physical and their kind of economic geography. But you can also see it is ripe for an exacerbation and a continuation, if you like, of the fundamental kind of social inequality and environmental justice issues that we see today in climate change and climate change impacts. So it is rightly held under quite a lot of scrutiny, carbon dioxide removal, because of its like manifold ways in which it can be misused, you know. And you don't have to have a lot of imagination for that. You just look at very analogous, you know, similar examples today. And so there's definitely ways of doing CDR well, both doing the actual practices well, you know, afforestation that benefits most people, local communities, you know, that versus doing kind of monoculture Sitka spruce and having large multinationals, you know, own vast tracts of land that suddenly push other people off. For example, that's, you can do afforestation badly too. So you can imagine each of the, you can see easily how they can be done, but also what we're showing here and what Harry's kind of discussed in really good detail here is how even at a national scale, your policy to get near to net zero, you can use CDR in a kind of, in a way that that either doesn't add up to carbon removals and net zero properly for the globe, or that is kind of exacerbates social and environmental inequalities and injustices. And so so it's a really useful tool, as I said right at the outset, but you need to do it well. You need to do it well. And again, it keeps coming back to making sure that focus is actually on how you decarbonize, you know, and the choices you make to decarbonize. Getting to net zero is like 95% about decarbonizing, you know, and the CDR is a little bit on the end, on this additional tool for us to use, because we want it in our back pocket, ready to use for this overshoot part that Harry was talking about at the beginning, the ability to actually reduce climate impacts in the latter half of the century.
Thanks. And I do have a follow-up question, which might be difficult to answer. I'm not sure. I am very curious. So, you know, how do we make sure, like, are there mechanisms to make sure that carbon dioxide removal methods aren't being used as an excuse by certain countries, as you mentioned, like the previous Australian government, to just continue burning fossil fuels or, you know, relying on coal, for example. Is there any way that, you know, are there mechanisms, policy processes, or do you think maybe the UNFCCC process is not enough to ensure that carbon dioxide removal methods are not being used as just like a way to continue doing what we're doing?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Mm. And something that I think haunts us as a research team somewhat is answering that question, because it gets at the nub of sort of the current approach to climate policy, which is that the Paris Agreement is necessarily bottom up, because you have all these different national circumstances that feed into decarbonization, and that's, you know, really displayed with our Switzerland example. In terms of the options they have available are different to a country like the UK, or different to a country like Australia. But there's also this concern about the misuse of CDR, which we also see in these pathways that are set out by some of these governments. There are ways in which some countries have tried to approach that in a top-down policy manner. So Sweden, for example, they have this climate policy framework where they say, according to our climate targets, we must reduce our emissions by 85%, excluding our forests, by compared to 1990 levels. And that leaves about 15% to be compensated through what they call supplementary measures. This could be putting their forests back into the equation, essentially, back into the balance of emissions. Or it could be the procurement of these carbon credits from abroad. So the Paris Agreement has what's known as Article 6, which is essentially the means of transferring some of the mitigation outcomes, the benefits of mitigation between countries. And you could do that with CDR, for example. Or there's, you know, essentially some further mitigation in there. So there you have sort of top-down approach. That's an approach that other countries could follow. But the crucial element is bringing the national circumstances back in, which is, why does Sweden have that target in the first place? It's because of their forest economy and what that enables them to do. So they'll go net negative very soon after reaching net zero because of their forest economy. And if you don't have that forest economy, then what is the right balance of residual emissions versus CDR? So that's the ongoing debate. There's been recent research to suggest it's about 18% across most countries that have this data. That's quite high. But in the UK, for example, it's a lot lower. So the UK, if you exclude its forests, it peaked in about 1991 in terms of its emissions. It's reduced by about half since then, according to about 2020 emissions. And then its residual emissions are about between 9 to 10% of its peak emissions in 1991. And so you can say that's good progress. But again, to the extent to which the geography plays into that is a different question. So part of this is pulling out climate ambition from national circumstance. And that's a very difficult challenge.
There have been some people that have said you should split out, as kind of Harry was insinuating that some countries have done there, you should split out your reductions from your removal. So you need to get to net zero, but you should express that in terms of how much decarbonisation you're doing. So how much you are reducing your emissions should be almost on a balance sheet separate, so that you can see who is trying to get away with that lazy option. Do you know what I mean? It's a bit like you can get to zero. The classic example is you can get to zero by having, you know, 100 units of positive emissions and 100 units of removal, or you can get to it by having two and two. And you can't always see that. And so there is potentially the option, some people argue, that you should set up some of the reporting so that that's clear and that can be clearly pulled out, so you can see how much that ambition is happening around decarbonisation. So that would kind of help you deal a little bit with the kind of previous Australian government example, because you would see it clearly. It would be clearly front and centre, easy to identify that they're actually not doing much on their ambition and they're using it as a way, using CDR. But then what Harry's just articulated there is about that subtlety of national circumstance. And at the end of the day, you know, there's arguments there about responsibility, you know, the kind of legacy responsibility. You know, it's not just where you're at now, it's also where you've been at, though you could argue it around those most likely to suffer vulnerabilities, those who still have, you know, a significant journey in terms of development to go, you know. So that kind of those questions, it's not just the geography, if you like, of a country, it's also mindful of the kind of development and other social objectives as well. So it's messy, it gets messy and complicated. And I don't think there'll be any structure within the UNFCCC that will perfectly resolve that. But there might be some tools that you could at least make it a little bit more obvious, you know, but make it more clear what's going on in terms of the thinking. And really, there should be a competition for ambition. There should be a competition for more decarbonisation, right? There should be all this innovation effort going into, well, how do we decarbonise cement? How do we decarbonise aviation, right? Or much more like, well, we're going to deal with our aviation emissions by investing in our rail infrastructure and investing in our public transport. That's how we're going to, you know, we're going to reduce the demand by giving alternatives, you know, a kind of palatable, making them accessible and affordable and available, alternative travel modes. You know, there's different ways to attack that problem rather than just seeing this as, can we get more and more CDR so that we don't have to do the thing we don't want to? But that will play out very differently in different countries that are dealing with, you know, dealing with climate ambition as part of a broader portfolio of issues, as well as mitigation and adaptation. Do you know what I mean? If you're in a country that's dealing heavily with climate impacts and is therefore incurring significant costs of adaptation, then you're not going to have a lot of cash available necessarily. Do you know what I mean? To do these, to do some of this. So I think sometimes us in the CDR space get a bit focused on the carbon numbers, and you've always got to, and what we're talking about here is putting those in national context in terms of economic and physical geography. But we've also got to put that in the context of also ongoing climate change and, you know, the ongoing over this century expression of climate change impacts and the adaptation that's required. And so so I think that kind of reality check again makes you, for me, each time it just loops back to do more decarbonisation and leave the fossil fuels in the ground as much as you can.
I think we've briefly touched on the implications of, you know, CDR methods for climate policy and how quantifying it might affect, you know, bottom-up or top-down approaches, especially in international climate policy like the Paris Agreement and the UNFCCC. Actually, this year is the COP28, which is the global stocktake, which means, you know, countries are going to review their commitments and say, you know, maybe it's enough, maybe it's not enough. So my first question is, using this, you know, this moment of COP28, how can countries improve their national climate strategies? And how important is this political moment for long-term commitments?
Yeah, so to take your first part in terms of improving the long-term strategies, some countries are on their second and perhaps even third iterations. Others have just submitted them for the first time. And they'll feed into the Stocktake process because they help elucidate some of the net zero goals that countries have set out as well. They're not simply just using the NDCs. And that helps us narrow what we can expect from the implementation of those plans. Whether those plans actually followed is perhaps a slightly different question. But certainly in terms of improving them, set out your modeling, first of all. That's our message from the lack of modeling that we see. Some countries perhaps might not be suited to doing that. So a good example is Tonga. Tonga say, we're such a small economy, we actually want to do some stakeholder sort of vision building process through that. And that's perhaps suited to a small island context. That perhaps doesn't apply to the likes of the Netherlands and Denmark, which also include no modeling. So if you're certainly a country that has the legacy of historical emissions, has the financial and technical capital to do so, you should be setting out quite a detailed national climate strategy that should feed into your domestic climate politics. So there's doing that as well, and also making sure that we make visible some of the CDR methods that we employ. So typically a lot of the modeling approaches fuse in things like BECCS and DACCS with other sectors. So Canada's a good example of this, where they put their BECCS industry sort of in with other industrial emissions. Therefore, we can't really understand the extent to which BECCS is utilized potentially. Whether that extends to other climate mitigation options is sort of like a question mark in our head. Should we do that for hydrogen, for example? I don't know. But nevertheless, making things visible helps us scrutinize those as civil society and also as academics and researchers alike. And then when it comes to the Stocktake, it's a pretty critical moment for the Paris Agreement. This will be a stress test, essentially, for whether the commitments that we have so far and the progress we've made to date stacks up to the IPCC pathways. So whether, particularly on climate finance, that we see enough financial flows going to developing countries, and also particularly on mitigation. So the NDCs, long-term targets, set out on the LTLEDs, for example, will play into that. I think what's missing from a lot of the debates is sort of one element of the Stocktake, which is international equity. Essentially, countries like India, who have just set out their strategy only recently, essentially say, our climate policy is premised on the global north doing more quicker and going net negative sooner. And so that's the sort of line in the sand when it comes to global climate diplomacy is what are you willing to do as global north countries to go net negative. And so countries like Germany, Iceland, Finland all have sort of net negative, not targets, but they have this ambition to go net negative after the net zero target. Whether those can be pulled forward and fleshed out further would be a sort of question for the Stocktake, or at least the sort of political outcomes of the Stocktake. So CDR, of course, is essential to doing that, but so is steep emission reductions.
I feel like we're beginning to sound like a stuck record, like going back to the point about the decarbonisation. I think that the global Stocktake will be a really useful, it's always nice to have plans, but to contrast those with actually what's been achieved, right? It's very easy to make a pledge. Yeah. We're going to protect 30% of nature by 2030 or whatever, we're going to protect this. We're going to protect. And then chucking the cold bucket of cold water over that of, okay, well, have you done this? Has this been delivered? What are the numbers? So I think nationally and within countries, it's very easy to make a pledge for another time, right? A decade is a nice long amount of time away. And so I think it's crucial that those are held to account. And so I think there'll be lots of interesting stuff emerges from that, whether it's about better practice, you know, whether it's about reflecting on the wins, you know, the kind of the positive stories in our global decarbonisation journey about, for example, solar and wind, you know, like I think it's important to look at, you know, those positives, but then also understand how, you know, making sure that this adds up and putting under scrutiny the sectors that that aren't doing the heavy lifting. So you can see that even within the UK, looking at like our transport sector emissions. So yeah, our overall economy is great, and that's with a lot of work's been done. A lot of that has been achieved through the power sector, but our transport emissions have gone up. You know, there's bigger, heavier cars on the road, and the kind of policy incentive has actually been towards more driving and less other modes of transport, you know, on balance across that. So so you can see that exercise happening nationally, a bit of a reality check, and being able to focus on what needs to happen next. So I think, I suppose what I'm saying is, even if the global stock take process makes for like slightly like, what's the opposite of hopeful? The other word, you know, if it's a little bit miserable in terms of what hasn't been achieved, it does, there is, even if it is a bit of a like, oh, we really have got a lot of work to do, as an exercise, there's also the elements of like, well, this has worked really well, and actually it's quite productive to have that reality check. And so even if it is on balance as not a positive story overall, having that reality check helps focus the attention on what needs to get done. Yeah, I think that's about that.
Thank you. Really good points there on how important, I guess, the COP28 is, and how, and reviewing the national strategies, making sure that we're on track. And, you know, the role of quantifying carbon dioxide removal methods will play in the future, in future scenarios, and in the commitments that countries will do. And also really good point on justice and equity, and, you know, what is the global north actually doing? But before we end our podcast, I'd like to engage our listeners and maybe give them advice on what they can do in engaging with this issue. So is there anything that they can do with this issue, like individually or with their communities or with certain groups, for example?
So yeah, I think there's a range of things that individuals can do. I think the more, wherever you are globally, if you're a company that you use or you trust or you you work for, have a net zero plan, have a look at it. Ask some questions of that. Has it got enough ambition on decarbonisation? Is it, you know, and then similarly, your city or your region or a kind of at a national level, you know, like being able to ask questions of your politicians or contribute to discussions with civil society organisations in your country or in your area. Asking those questions of does this stuff add up? Does, you know, and what are the checks and balances to make sure that real action's happening, and this whole conversation about CDR or getting to net zero isn't just greenwashing? I think if that does not lift your mental health, you should maybe think about things that do. And so getting involved locally, again, in local organisations that are tree planting, you know, we're not saying that tree balancing fossil fuel emissions out with forests and soils is risky for a set of reasons, but forests and soils are still really, really important for lots of other reasons, right? So taking that positive action in your local area, you know, even within urban areas, urban trees and urban green space is really important for climate mitigation and adaptation as well, and as well as tackling biodiversity loss. So anywhere where anyone listening to this podcast in the world, there will be somewhere locally to you where something to do with trees and green space would be a useful benefit, a range of benefits, including climate action. So I think that is important to feed into the positive element. And then the other element is the kind of conversations and dialogues with companies or cities and regions about what their net zero plans are, and asking some questions and kind of pushing that ambition so that it's about decarbonizing rather than just making a pledge, is that being carried out? I think that kind of scrutiny, I think people could do their own global stock take at whichever national, you know, whichever governance level is relevant to them. And if you feel that that's too much of a step for you individually, then getting involved with a civil society organization that's got the connections and the understanding and the resource to be able to do that is a ways that you can help. Or maybe even in your back garden or on your balcony, just something more in terms of greenery is good. It's just not good enough to offset a massive fossil fuel industry in 2050. That's all. Harry, did you want to add anything else?
No, I agree that completely. I think, you know, this is the sort of net zero era. Everything is net zero. Everyone has a net zero target. It's kind of this all aboard approach to climate policy. As a result, it's quite symbolic and quite kind of fanfare-y in some sense. So making sure that those net zero commitments are backed by credibility is crucial. There's a net zero tracker, for example, that's an online resource where you can go and look up different companies that perhaps you purchase from, companies you're a part of, organizations, even countries, making sure that you understand, perhaps explore those climate plans and bring that into your civil society discussions, into your social movements. And CDR is a part of that, but making sure it's the right part of it is crucial. And then if you're interested in CDR specifically, perhaps you're interested in sort of techies kind of side, how does some CDR methods work, particularly on the sort of engineered side, go and look at the Open Air Collective, which is a global bottom-up collective looking at global advocacy for engineered methods and also how they should design things like direct air capture in the future. So I think those positive and the sort of being the sort of judge and jury, yeah, it's a good balance, I think, to personal climate action.
Well, thank you. Thanks both, Harry and Anne. Thanks for joining us today. And we hope our listeners learned more about the importance of CDR and what it means for our long-term strategies to decarbonize the world by 2050. And of course, some great advice there at the very end on how each one of us can engage ourselves in this issue, in this topic. And see you in the next Tindle Talks.